This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho, featuring inspirational and fascinating personal stories of people from all corners of the globe who are now in St. Louis. We'll take a look at the U.S. through newcomers' eyes, get some insight into world history and cultures, and maybe learn something about ourselves. Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Welcome back to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL. Tonight, I'm joined by Vicente Estrada, who's called Vince here, Estrada, and he's from Cuba, or Cuba, I guess you would say in Spanish, right?
Cuba would be in Spanish.
Okay. Well, I think a lot of people are familiar with Cuba, more or less. Can you tell us, like, where you'd find it on the map, how far off the coast it is?
Yeah, very quickly. It's the largest island in the Caribbean. By far, it is some 700 miles long, which is the distance between St. Louis and Toronto, Canada.
Oh, wow.
And it's just 90 miles south of Key West, Florida.
Okay. And I just wanted to briefly go through just a little bit of history, and then we're going to talk about your story. But I understand that was the Taino people were the main indigenous inhabitants when the Spanish came.
There were two or three tribes, but Tainos, is the way they pronounce it. I understand. I wasn't there at the time.
You're not that old.
there were Tainos, Siboneyes, and some other small one. But yeah, that was the main one that was found over there when the Europeans arrived.
And then that was, Columbus came, right, to Cuba?
Columbus was the first one, thinking that he was in India, but yeah.
Right.
He came to Cuba was not the first one he hit, but, came and found the natives over there. Those natives, by the way, just a quick comment, unlike the civilizations of Mexico, the Aztecs or the Peruvian Incas, was not an advanced civilization. They were very sedentary, live off the land, and that's when they put into hard labor, and that's how they got exterminated, really.
Okay. But I understand that they had a fairly sophisticated tobacco production.
They did. They did tobacco and some other things, but, they were not a warring tribe.
And the... Is it true that tobacco is actually a Taino word?
That's I understand that is the case. Yeah. Okay.
And so the famous Cuban cigars are because of the Taino people.
Yep.
Prehistory. I read that Spain brought 800,000 Africans to Cuba to work as slaves.
There was when the native population started disappearing because diseases brought by the Europeans and
was it mostly disease as opposed to just slaughter?
It was both hard labor that they were not
hard labor
and in diseases. They start bringing slaves from Africa. Yes, the traffic, slave traffic, was very, very, very significant. Mm-hmm. And I just read a magnificent book about the history of Cuba in the United States, but it's more than meets the eye. Yes, they brought in more slaves than U.S. did.
Twice as many as came to the United States.
But it was after the abolition here, Americans went to Cuba because there was slave labor over there, so farmers and so forth did a lot of investment in Cuba, taking advantage of. So Spain became kind of a, aid in that respect. But yes, the traffic of the island of Cuba is Afro-Spanish, if you want to.
What is the race relations in Cuba? Is it good? Is it
bad? I mean, right now I couldn't tell you, but
you were growing up there.
When I was growing up, I mean, it was peaceful, but was there discrimination? Yes. There were some notable black people in Cuba, artists, Celia Cruz, you may have heard of her, and baseball players that came and played, in the United States. But generally, a good number of the black people were servants who were domestics and so forth. Some were successful, but yeah.
A lot of mixed marriages and a lot of
racial... mixed marriage. The mixture of Caucasian and black is called mulatto.
And then maybe remnants of the Taino population?
No, there was no vestige of any kind in the Caribbean because of what I just told you. Certainly in Cuba, there is nothing.
No, that. Well, slavery was at ultimately abolished. Well,
slavery was particularly for the sugar cane business.
Okay. Can you talk about Jose Marti?
Jose Marti was the intellectual leader of the Cuban revolution. There's certain bias in what I say. The real revolution.
That would have been time era?
In the 1800s.
Okay.
That war against Spain, the War of Independence.
Yeah.
And at the end, it was called the Spanish-American War. But, the War of Independence lasted about 30 years, on and off. So starting about 1868, Martín spent most of his time, they threw him out of Cuba, the Spaniards, because he was beginning to create some discomfort, spent most of his time in the United States and did most of the leadership. He was a political leader of the War of Independence against Spain.
Okay, a symbol of Cuban independence, I guess.
Too. Absolutely. Oh, revered. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, no question.
Now, with the Spanish-American War, is it true that the United States basically gained control of Cuba after that?
For from 1898 to 1902.
1902.
It did. They did. And they had a general over there in charge and so forth, and finally negotiated. I think it was called the Platt Amendment, and that the United States reserved the right to intervene if something went, and also the Guantanamo Bay Agreement came out of that, and that,
which,
talk
about that. Where is that exactly in Cuba?
Guantanamo is a city in the easternmost and the southeast part of the island.
And do we have? We control that today, and is there like a...
It's a naval base.
Is there a deadline to when that's going to happen?
United States pays Cuba for it, and rumored has it that Castro has not cashed any of the checks. Yes, that may be legend. I don't know.
Okay, wow.
But that is a naval base. And there hasn't been any conflict at all, which is really amazing.
It's counterintuitive.
It is amazing.
There were, series of leaders in Cuba. We're not going to go through all of them, but I want to talk about Batista he had the presidency twice, right?
He had the presidency twice. He had, and I just made a note just so that he had two coups. The one that you mentioned here was the last one, but he was also involved in a coup in 1933, and then turned over the government, and there were elections, somebody else was elected, and so forth. But he was president twice, and the second one is the one that caused the Castro revolution.
And you were, I think you told me you were born, I hope you don't mind, I'm going to say you were born in 1938.
I was.
Okay. And then you were a young kid when Batista did his second coup.
I was a teenager.
You were a teenager, okay.
And I was in Cuba, obviously.
Let's talk about, I guess, your childhood there in Cuba. And do you remember what happened or how things changed when Batista gained control after that second coup, if at all, average person?
Actually, other than the fact that he ousted the president, by the way, it's not Socarrás, it's Prio. Socarrás is his mother's maiden name, but... not much. He took charge, military guy, ultimately call elections. There was a lot of opposition to Batista. He was, and particularly towards the end, he was ruthless. He was corrupt. The thing that did in Cuba was the corruption, and, towards the end, most Cubans were in favor of Batista being ousted, and we supported Castro.
Interesting. Yeah, let's Before we get, I want to go
but
back
yeah,
and
Batista,
talk.
Yeah, Batista, yeah. Batista is a figure important
yeah.
in the history of the island.
Right. Let's talk about your childhood, though. You were born before Batista came in the second time. What was your childhood like? Where did you live? In Havana?
No. Sometimes I feel guilty about talking about my life in Cuba because it was really good.
Well, that's fine. I'm glad to hear that.
My father worked for the Cuban American Sugar Company, and my father was bilingual, so he was general manager of a sugar mill. There were 168 sugar mills in Cuba, by the way.
Wow.
They're 38 now. And so I grew up as a child. I was born in the provincial city of Matanzas, but only was there because my father wanted a doctor to deliver me. But then we went to the small town where the sugar mill is, towards the eastern part of the island. My father, my mother had seven siblings. They all worked at the sugar mill, so we had a big family there. I had 21 cousins. I had a lot of people. It was my youth. Was a very happy youth, very, very happy youth.
What was your school like?
And it was a very small town. I was trying to figure out. I not very much. There were even 2,000 people living in that sugar mill town. School, from kindergarten to third grade, homeschooled, but not at my house, but by my mother. Homeschooled at the home of a teacher.
Oh, was that common?
No. I was not. She had a little school. Then in fourth grade, I went to the public school in this town called, the town was called Francisco. I went to the public school for the first semester. And then my parents decided to send me to a school in Havana. Havana was quite a distance from there. You know, it was by car probably 14 hours. So I went to a Jesuit school, all boys, as a boarding student because my parents lived away from there. And I spent second semester of fourth grade to high school. And as I wrote in my autobiography, probably the most normative and formative years of my young life. I mean, it was an extraordinary education. And on vacation, I went back to the town, our hometown, Francisco. I had 21 cousins, you know, bike riding, horseback riding. We have the beach nearby because it had a port, fishing, had a social club, a theater. It was good.
Your life was good, but did a lot of people not have such a good life in those days?
No. The island, I tell you, there are some very interesting statistics about Cuba. There was... in the 50s, it was the largest producer of sugar in the world, Cuba. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a lot of American investment there, and that plus the tourism plus the tobacco, the economy of the country was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
The educational system was very strong, and there were some rumors about Castro fixed the literacy and health and so forth. Before he took over, there was an 80% literacy in Cuba, third in Latin America. The infant mortality, ninth lowest in the world ahead of France, Belgium, and Italy, and so forth. So it was in part because of the proximity to the United States and the relationships that existed and the economy and all that. Were there poor people? Yes. Were there peasants? Yes. And there were different classes? Yes.
Yes.
My family was considered, and my parents were considered upper middle class. You know, he was general manager of sugar mill and bilingual and so forth and so on. But it was not the downtrodden society that some of the astro apologists make you
okay.
think.
Okay. Well, I think we need to take our first short break here. So we're going to come back and pick up the story in a minute. You're listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Cuando salí de Cuba, dejé mi vida, dejé mi amor.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by Arnell's Hardwoods. For all of your laminate and hardwood flooring needs, call them at 314-397-3252.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by the Indoor Comfort Team. For all of your heating and cooling needs, call the Indoor Comfort Team at 314-230-9542.
Cuando salí de Cuba, dejé mi vida, dejé mi amor.
This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Welcome back. We're talking to Mr. Vicente Estrada about his childhood in Cuba. And you were saying that your life was pretty good in Cuba in the early 50s, I guess the mid-50s.
Yep.
Why was it that Batista performed this coup then? How did he think he could improve things? Or what was his motivation?
My view, and I think the view of a lot of people who have started, power grabbing.
Okay.
Just ego. He wanted to be in charge again.
Was he a more like conservative, liberal, radical? What did he have a political agenda to carry out?
No. I mean, he was corrupt. He was, I'm going to guess, more conservative, but not a value-based conservative.
And then what changes did he implement, if at all? How did things change?
The economy was quite good while he was president.
Okay.
No. A lot of it is tied to the proximity of the United States. Not that we were slaves of the United States, but you're having the largest market in the world 90 miles away from you, and we, the largest producer of sugar in the world. Duh.
So he didn't.
There was a comment. Was there organized crime? Gambling? Yes. And some of the organized crime people in the United States, the figures that were well known at the time, own some of the organized crime in terms of, extorting, but organized crime in the sense that, they bribed the government, there was gambling, but it was legal.
We think of it as a gambling mecca, I guess.
It was, and again, a lot of tourism, easy to get to.
Yeah.
40 minutes from Miami on an airplane.
Were there a lot of American tourists in the 50s?
Not only American, but from all over the world. But for Americans, yes, absolutely, yes.
Okay.
The beaches in Cuba were just absolutely gorgeous. I mean, gorgeous.
Well, now, you actually came to the United States originally in that time, right?
It did, 1956, and
that was before Castro.
No, before Castro. Actually, he started his revolution in 1956, but it was not because of that I came.
Okay.
It was part of our family plan that I would come to study engineering in the United States.
Okay.
My father had studied here, and he was a great fan of education, so I came to engineering school. The school that I went to, the Jesuit school, I consider it to be a world-class school, prepared me so well that I was accepted. I'm sorry if it sounds like I'm bragging, but I was accepted to all 10 engineering schools I applied in this country, including the one I graduated from.
Which one was that?
MIT. And I say, are you bragging about it? No, I'm bragging about the Jesuits who educated me and my father who had the foresight of moving me in that direction. So I came in 1956, graduated with every intent of going back to Cuba, work in the sugar industry. I'm a chemical engineer.
Yeah.
I wanted to work in the sugar industry. And when I got there and we look around and I saw Russian ships in the bay and Castro saying socialism or death, communism was around the corner.
And you can see that happening while you... Happened.
I mean, everybody was beginning to see it already.
Well, before we talk about that, I want to talk about your experience coming here as an international student.
Yep.
You lived in the dormitory, I guess.
I did all 4 years, interestingly, I love living in the dormitory. The school, even though it's very famous, was a relatively small school. I was within fucking. I lived in the dorm. It was a relatively small school, a sense of community. So I loved living in the dorm.
And were there any cultural adjustments?
Yes,
that you had to deal with.
I thought about that when the question. Not really, except for food.
Oh. Okay.
I don't know if that's cultural or not, but that's the only adjustments I had to.
Was it
I mean, different. And it's not, okay. That's not good or bad. It's just different. But no major cultural. When I was very young, my father saw to it that I had a tutor. So when I was 7 years old, I was fluent in English. So when I arrived in the United States, the language was in Onish.
Had you traveled here before?
Yes. We did. I had a brother who really was disabled from shortly after birth, and we came often. We came sometimes, you know, to see doctors, but I came to New York. I have been here before. So the United States as a neighbor country, very stable, very friendly, and I did not feel awkward at all coming to the United States or going to, you know, unlike some of the people who had to get on a boat.
Yeah.
I came on an airplane, 45-minute flight.
Yes. And you were here for 4 years then?
I was here for, yeah, except for, you know, the summer vacation and the Christmas holidays, I went back to Cuba.
So by the time you graduated, Castro had taken over.
Castro took over January 1st, 1959, which is halfway through my junior year. And I happened to be in Cuba because it was Christmas holiday.
Oh. Was it hard to leave and come back to the United States then?
It was not as hard as it was after that, because when the United States and Cuba did not break relations until 1961. So when I decided to leave in 1960, 2 months after I graduated, I had a student visa because I had been accepted to graduate school. So I came in, and I also had a job offer from a Cuban company that had operations in the United States, Bacardi Rum. They have an office, made me an offer. I accepted. It's a long story on that one. They ultimately lost the company because Castro nationalized every single. Anyway, so I came in as a student with a student visa. And then once I was here, I went through the process of becoming a permanent resident, a so-called green card, which by the way, is blue.
Right. I don't know why they call it a green
card. I don't know. And then after that, there is a period and so forth, and I became a citizen. In between there, I got married. That's story on its own. When I left Cuba, I was engaged.
Oh. I think you said that there were some Cubans that kind of were supporting Castro before he took over.
Immediately after that, I'm going to say the great majority of Cubans supported Castro, myself included.
Why was that? What was his message?
Because we wanted to get rid of an oppressive, autocratic, corrupt government and restore democracy as we understood it.
And what did Castro promise he would do?
He promised that while he was fighting Batista. Shortly after he took power, not long after that, he said, I have always been, will always be, a Marxist-Leninist.
You didn't say that before?
So the sense of people like me and many, 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 many people in Cuba, including those who fought alongside him, is we got betrayed.
Mm-hmm.
We got betrayed. In the 1960s, you know, this happened. Cuba had 6 million people.
Oh.
6 million people.
Okay.
1 million exile.
Many of them came here, I guess.
The great majority came to the United States, a bunch of them to Miami. That's, by the way, equivalent to 50 million Americans leaving into exile, which is the entire state of Texas and Florida. I just did that arithmetic, and that's it.
That's a good analogy. Who was Che Guevara?
Che Guevara.
He was not even Cuban, right?
No, he was born in Argentina, a doctor, a physician. I've been to his town, the town of his birth, many times on business. I never practiced medicine. He became a revolutionary whose cause, and it goes, you know, it's all been written up, I'm not making it up, is the demise of imperialistic countries like the United States. I was just reading something yesterday. He was enemy of peaceful coexistence and did not like what Khrushchev was doing, this peaceful coexistence, all of that. That was not, he said.
So even Khrushchev was too soft for him.
The mutual peaceful coexistence was not for him. He was a revolutionary, bright individual, very strong personality. Eventually, Castro sent him, or he went on his own to Bolivia to start a revolution over there. They were waiting for him, the army, and they killed him.
But he was, I guess, one of Castro's advisors.
Absolutely. He was he was probably more so than Castro's brother. More so than Raul.
Okay.
He was, I would say, from a revolution point of view, Castro's right-hand man.
And did, when Castro, before the coup, before Castro took power, did he proudly associate with Guevara?
They met in Mexico. Castro had an attempt in 1956 or 7. He assaulted an army post, and they were captured. And it was just a huge fiasco for them. He was thrown in jail, condemned to I don't know how many years. And somebody convinced Batista that it would be better off if he pardon these people and throw them out of Cuba. Huh? Big mistake. Castro went to Mexico. That's where he met Guevara.
Okay.
Just, you know, serendipitously.
And you said that a lot of people were kind of supporting Castro before he took over. Were they also supporting Guevara?
Well,
they know about him.
They didn't know as much about him, but we supported him implicitly because we supported that movement that was going to oust the dictator and restore democracy, clean democracy. Didn't. So, yes. The only person that I know personally who did not support Castro and he said, this is not good news, and everybody looked at him, was my father. And I don't know why he had an issue. He said, this is not good news, guys.
Well, how did life change under Castro? Was it immediate?
Particularly after they broke relations with the United States in 1961. It's communist, total government control. Strong support of the army. Imagine a country that had a population of 6 million and the size of the army was 1 million.
Mm. It was forced conscription, I guess. They were forced.
These are people who, a lot of them would fought with him. No, these are. So a dictatorial, a communist, single party, no opposition, no freedom of speech. No private education. He threw all the Jesuits out of Cuba. By the way, he graduated from the same school I did. Fortunately for me, we did not coincide at that school. So it's something I don't have to say. Oh, I met him in school.
Yeah.
Bright guy.
You said he nationalized all the businesses too.
And private property.
Right, like immediately, or how long did that take?
It would take less than 2 years.
Was there resistance against him? Did
yeah.
People try to...
Well, you imagine people who, you know, work all their life. My father invested, you know, in real estate and rented the real estate. And when Castro decided, no, those are houses are the house of the people. And he took them over, every one of them.
If people tried to resist or protest in the streets?
It was repression. If you tried to do that, they were repressed. That's why... So many Cubans left. And interesting, most of the Cubans who left in the 60s, which was the big exodus, were professionals. It was doctors, lawyers, Newsprint. Architects, engineers. Mm-hmm. Miami was ecstatic, you know, we landed a whole bunch of...
You said they closed down the Catholic schools and private schools?
Oh, yeah.
What about the Catholic Church or other churches?
They were... tolerated in principle, it got better. I mean, they're functioning today after the Pope John Paul II visited the island, and I think after that, as a gesture, they allow there is there is some, quote, freedom of religion, but obviously if you work for the government, you're not supposed to be.
And I think you alluded to this a few minutes ago, but, you know, we often hear that Castro improved the education, the literacy rate, and also health care, but you're saying it was already pretty good before.
It was already pretty good before they sustained it, because interestingly enough, yes, they sustained it because the health care doctors, physicians, became a source of income, because he sent them out to other countries and charged for each physician $20,000 per month per head from the countries that he sent. And they were good physicians. I'm not saying they're not. I happened to have met one in Angola, Africa. So in that sense, yeah, but it was the better physicians were sent out to earn money for the government.
And the literacy, I mean, the education that he...
The education was maintained. It's all state-run education.
It's mandatory education up to age 16 or something?
Yeah, it is. In fact, it was even before he came. But that education, it's all public. And attached to it comes the indoctrination on Marxist principles.
Yeah.
So private education ceased to exist very quickly.
All right, I think we need to take another short break here, but we will be right back and continue this discussion. You're listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Late y sigue latiendo, porque mi tierra vida le da. Pero llegará el día en que mi mano.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by Samim Afghan Restaurant, featuring traditional Afghan cuisine and conveniently located on Manchester Road in the Grove.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you by Hacking Law, for individuals who want to come and stay in the U.S. Hacking Law fights for immigrants every day. Visit them at hackingimmigrationlaw.com.
Cuando salí de Cuba, dejé mi vida, dejé mi amor.
This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Welcome back to Stories of New Americans. We're talking to Vicente Estrada. Now, you happened to be back in Cuba when Castro took control, but then you ultimately came back here again and finished your studies.
That is correct.
And then did you stay here, or did you go back and get married and come back here again?
No, I do a very quickly story. No, I did not go back. When I left August 21st, 1960, I've never been back to Cuba. Something I regret.
You still haven't gone back.
No, it's something I regret. But I know it's going to break my heart. But I was engaged when I left. And what we did, and, you know, it was, by that time, there were no relationship between the two countries, so it was not easy to get out. My father's family had a branch of the family in Mexico. They always came from Spain to Mexico, so he had a very influential cousin over there. So what we did is I gave my father a power of attorney. We got married, she in Cuba, I in the United States, by power of attorney. My father stood in for me. A proxy marriage. This little 4 foot tall woman with my father was 6 feet tall. And then she had, you know, we were married. So when she went to Mexico, went to the American embassy, says, here's my marriage. My husband is asking for me. She got a visa in 2 days and came. And then we got married again. So we joke that we are bigamists to each other. And we have been married for, it's going to be 62 years this year.
Now, did you continue to live in the Boston area, or how did you wind up in St. Louis?
Very quickly. When I left, and because I had a job with Bacardi, which is really to be trained, I went to New York, which spent a semester in Columbia University. Bacardi lost the company, so they had to let me go. I went to Boston, went to MIT Alumni Association Employment Service, got a job with Monsanto in Cincinnati.
Oh.
In Cincinnati. I, you know, and then we got married, and my wife came to Cincinnati. You know, we got married in Miami, Cincinnati. All of our children were born there. I worked for Monsanto for 10 years. So we live in Cincinnati for 16 years. Love the city, very similar to St. Louis. And then I got a job offer with a consulting company, which was based in St. Louis, an international mid-sized consulting company. And it attracted me, and I accepted the job, and they promoted me to management, and that caused us to move to St. Louis, which was also a place that we have come to really love. All of our kids were born in Cincinnati, but they really grew up in St. Louis, most of them. Our oldest daughter in high school here when she came, but, you know. So it was that. It was New York, Boston, Cincinnati, St. Louis, and we've been in St. Louis since 1977.
Now, your parents were still in Cuba when you came here, and other
relatives? My parents did. After, when we got married, there was still an ability to come in. My father and mother, for some reason, still had a visa. They came for my wedding, for our wedding in Miami, just for the 2 or 3 days that, you know, they came. And the day of the wedding, the same day of the wedding, they returned to Cuba. Turns out my father had a very advanced cancer. We tried to get him to the United States, and before we could even, he died. And so the last time I saw him was on my wedding day. And then my mother and my disabled brother and my grandmother were eventually able to leave.
Oh.
You know, I mean, it was possible, but it was very difficult. So she came and settled in Miami with a niece, because, you know, we lived in St. Louis in winters and the culture difference, so we decided to stay in Miami. My mother came and died at the ripe old age of 103.
Wow. And you have other relatives that are still in Cuba now, close cousins?
I have some aging cousins, maybe 2 or 3 cousins that couldn't want to leave or couldn't leave, you know. But other than that, family is, yeah.
You don't have contact with anybody there now?
None. Two of our children visited Cuba on some of the exchange, you know, so an organization, so they were able to go, both two of them, including going to the house where I lived and my wife lived. And they said it broke their heart to see. I mean, it's the condition of the place is...
The sugar company that you worked at is now, is it defunct, or is it like a nationalized company now?
It's defunct. Nothing. No, it's defunct. It's defunct. The sugar industry went from 168 mills to, I think, less than 40. It couldn't maintain them.
Is it still a major producer of sugar?
It's not the major producer in the world. It still produces
and tobacco too,
and tobacco, yeah, but it's not what it used to be.
Yeah,
they can't maintain them.
Now, when you came here in the early '60s, the second time, what was the reaction of Americans when they learned you were from Cuba? Did they must have heard about what was happening in Cuba with Castro? How did they have questions for you, or did they? Were they afraid of you, or what was your relationship with Americans that you met?
I have never felt more welcome in my life. Now, remember, I came from Cuba. The reason Cubans were leaving Cuba is because the country turned communist. Communism was the arch rival of the United States. So Cubans, the United States went out of their way to welcome Cubans and help settle and so forth. Now, the fact that most of us were professionals and came, and, you know, modesty aside, added value to here, it didn't come handout.
Yeah.
I felt very welcome. I felt very at home. Language, as I told you, was not an issue thanks to the foresight of my father.
Did you make American friends in St.
Louis
easily?
Oh, yeah. But also a mixture, because in Cincinnati especially, there was an association of Cuban exiles, and we met twice a month at a church for service, and I played the guitar, and then we had a social after, and we have friends. But in school, There were a lot of people from Latin America when I was in school, but I made friends with Americans, some of my partners for laboratory and so forth. I felt in community almost from the get-go. Never felt threatened, never felt looked out. Occasionally, somebody said, "Oh, you don't look Cuban." I said, "What does a Cuban look like?"
Yeah. Well, you told me that people think you have an Irish accent.
I don't know where that comes from. There's more than once, and I said, "I have a Brogue accent. Where's that coming from?" because I have traveled the world, and for business, I have, other than Cuba and the United States, I've been in 31 other countries, 11 of which are Spanish-speaking.
Yeah.
My original Cuban accent may have been modified, so I may
probably
have
morphed a lot. Is there a Cuban community in St. Louis?
Not as much as it was in Cincinnati. Now, is there some people here? There, most of them for some reason. Well, I know the reason. We're doctors. St. Louis hospitals attract a lot of people. You know, Barnes and Mercy and all that. So we made good friends with some, but it was not the same. It was nothing organized like it was in Cincinnati. Cincinnati was an organized group and have events and.
Did you think in those early days, did you and your wife think that it would, maybe Castro would, there'd be another coup that he would leave? Or did you think you could ever go back?
Bay of Pigs.
Okay.
That was
the hope.
The hope. In retrospect, it was naive to think that 1,500 people landing and facing an army of 15,000, which is the statistic.
Can you explain a little bit about what the Bay of Pigs was all about?
Bay of Pigs was a CIA, this is public knowledge.
Yeah.
It was a CIA organized group of all Cuban exiles that were trained in Guatemala, in a camp, and there was a plan to land in the island, invade the island, not invade, land the island, set a beachhead, and then connect with the underground over there, which was very, 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 very large. For reasons that I don't think history knows what they are, Castro knew about it, and he was waiting for. My wife happened to be in Cuba still during the Bay of Pigs. Some of my best friends was part of that brigade at 2506, and many of my friends.
This was 1960, right?
1961.
61.
There's a letter from my best friend from jail in Cuba that I found in my drawer the other day. And there was supposed to be U.S. Air support for the people who were not. Castro was waiting for them. How they found out, we'll never know. And so that failed, and the people spent 2 years in jail, and there were ransom from private funds, and came back to the U.S.
So after that, did you kind of lose hope of a regime change?
Yes. And even if there were people who wanted that to happen, it is so repressive. You know, you cannot have an organized meeting on the street. You can't. That's against the law. So
what is it? I know you haven't ever gone back there, and you don't really have context there now, but do you get a sense that it's a little bit less repressive now than it was in the 60s?
Just as repressive.
Just as, like, after Fidel's brother Raul took over, was there any kind of a change then?
Raul was a figurehead. Raul's intellect is not what his brother was. Raul is, close to 90 years old now. He was more of a figurehead, but there was already a well-established machinery entrenched in with a huge army. Remember, Russia or the Soviet Union at the time was supporting Cuba big time.
And when they fell apart, a lot of their financial support left too, right?
Collapsed. And I think China tried to, but yeah, it collapsed. And then they turned to Venezuela, but that also collapsed after Chavez died. It absolutely collapsed. You know, there is a quota of what you can buy food-wise. You know, you can only buy so many eggs per month and so forth, and you have the economy of the country. I say that with tears in my eyes. The people are suffering just because I was reading the other day. You know, I appreciate what you're doing, the interview, because it fed me to go look at things that I've been meaning to. I read the official psychological profile of Fidel Castro was prepared by the CIA. I have it here.
From those days in the 60s?
Yes. And it is what most people think it was, but now it's official. It's owned by psychiatrists, a group of psychiatrists. He has an incredible need for adulation. He cannot be wrong. And if anybody crosses him, he responds viciously. And I think so was Hitler, so was Stalin, so was Mao.
Requisite.
It seems to be big intelligence, big ego,
yeah,
big problem.
Well, now this new leader, Diaz-Canel. Is he a figurehead?
We don't know much about him. The word was, and as I said, I met a Cuban doctor and became very close friends in Angola when I was doing a project. It seems to be a more pragmatic individual. I mean, he grew up in the regime as a communist. More pragmatic, less, but there is also a school of thought that it's similar to North Korea. The real power is not the guy, it's the army behind. And when you have that, the machinery is already in place. So the repression will continue. There was an attempt last year to go on the streets and protest, against the government and so forth. They sent tanks out on the street.
So do you have hope that maybe not in your lifetime.
Not in my lifetime.
But maybe after that, you think there's a chance that it will change?
Well, the Soviet Union collapsed, although it makes you wonder these days.
Yeah.
There's always hope, but in my lifetime, not likely.
In spite of the political situation there, I'm sure you love the Cuban culture, and I'm sure you've tried to keep it alive in your home here. How have you been able to do that?
Oh, well, my wife's Cuban, I'm Cuban. It's very interesting. My family, my very large family, has a very strong identity of their Cuban heritage. They love it. Whenever we have a family meal at home, you know, the COVID kind of, that is in a different direction, but it's Cuban food. My wife's black beans are famous in the family. Her flan is famous, and the expectation is at that table there will be Cuban food, and they love it.
Okay. So flan, black beans, what are some other typical Cuban?
Roast pork, plantains. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the staples, you know, because Caribbean food. I mean, it's not unique to Cuba, but my wife makes black beans that are famous in our family.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
And then
Cuban coffee.
Oh, yeah. Did your kids grow up speaking Spanish at home?
Initially, yes, but once I hit school, and it's immersion in English, it's very difficult to sustain that.
Do you speak Spanish to your kids now understand it?
They do understand it, and one of them is married to a Cuban, although they talk to each other in English. Yes. By the way, when you and I were on the phone the other day, number 35 in our family was born.
Oh, congratulations. Was that in St. Louis or somewhere else?
And this one was born in Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay. You're growing. Now, you play music with some of your family members, right?
I have a son who is a very good guitar player. He's manager of information technology for WashU Medical School, but that's not his profession. But he plays with groups. He's very good. I play guitar by ear. My mother learned how to play piano by ear and played until she was 100 years old piano.
Wow. And this song that we're playing throughout this interview during our breaks, that was you singing, right?
I'm afraid that all of them, it's me singing. It's good microphone. It was done in a professional studio here in St. Louis.
Yeah. Oh, no, it sounds good to me. Yeah.
And that song says, when I left Cuba, I left my heart, I left my love.
Mm.
That's what that song says.
Gosh.
And I literally left my love because my future wife was left behind.
Yeah. We'll see how it wound up coming, though. Do you think you'll ever get a chance to go back, visit before?
You know, it was on my bucket list, but I don't know. You know, I worry at my age. You haven't done the arithmetic. I was born in 1938. So.
Yeah.
But then again, Mom died at 103, so I don't know how long I'm going to be around. Yeah. So I thought I wanted to go. To the tomb of my father and see my old school and so forth. But both of my kids were gone. I said, please do go, but it's going to break your heart.
Yeah, I bet. Okay. Well, in our final minutes here, do you have any kind of a message for our listeners, a final thought, something you'd like to share with us as a...
I do. Okay. I do. And it is this. Yeah. I'm not sure it's wisdom, but because I travel a lot, you know, the world, I found myself often having to explain to people who ask because they're interested and sometimes defend the United States in terms of why it makes you guys so good, so prominent. And I find myself saying, I don't think we're smarter than the rest of the world or have more resources. But what my sense of this, my very strong sense of this, is this country, unlike any other country I have seen, has a respect for the institutions that no other country has, the respect for the balance of power that exists, no matter how we feel politically. And I think about 9/11 came in, park your differences aside, and we all got together as a nation.
We did for a while.
Mm-hmm. I hope it doesn't take crisis for that. And the way I sum it up for the people I tried to explain it, in this society, a whole is more than the sum of its parts.
I like that. That sounds good. Thank you for sharing that word of wisdom. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Interview.
It's been a privilege.
My pleasure. Thank you. You've been listening to Stories of New Americans here on News Talk STL 101.9, 94.1.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.